Chapter 4. A brisk little gentleman, who had made the journey in the same coach with Pogson, but had more modestly taken a seat in the Imperial, here passed us, and greeted me with a, "How do you do?" He had shouldered his own little valise, and was trudging off, scattering a cloud of commissionaires, who would fain have spared him the trouble. "Do you know that chap?" says Pogson. "Surly fellow, ain't he?" "The kindest man in existence," answered I. "All the world knows little Major British." "He's a major, is he? Why, that's the fellow that dined with us at Kilyax's. It's lucky I did not call myself captain before him. He mightn't have liked it, you know." And then Sam fell into a reverie. What was the subject of his thoughts soon appeared. "Did you ever see such a foot and ankle?" said Sam, after sitting for some time, regardless of the novelty of the scene, his hands in his pockets, plunged in the deepest thought. "Isn't she a slap-up woman, eh, now?" pursued he, and began enumerating her attractions, as a horse jockey would the points of a favorite animal. "You seem to have gone a pretty length already," said I, "by promising to visit her tomorrow." "A good length? I believe you. Leave me alone for that. But I thought you were only to be two in the coop, you wicked rogue." "Two in the coopy? Oh. Ah. Yes, you know why, that is, I didn't know as he had her maid with her. What an ass I was to think of a noblewoman traveling without one. And couldn't, in course, refuse, when she asked me to let the maid in. Of course not. Couldn't, you know, as a man of honor. But I made up for all that," said Pogson, winking slyly, and putting his hand to his little bunch of a nose, in a very knowing way. "You did, and how? Why, you dog, I sat next to her, sat in the middle the whole way, and my back's half broke, I can tell you." And thus, having depicted his happiness, we soon reached the inn, where this back-broken young man was to lodge during his stay in Paris. The next day at 5 we met. Mr. Pogson had seen his Baroness, and described her lodgings, in his own expressive way, as "lap up." As he had received him quite like an old friend, treated him to eau sucre, of which beverage he expressed himself a great admirer, and actually asked him to dine the next day. But there was a cloud over the ingenuous youth's brow, and I inquired still farther. "Why," said he, with a sigh, "I thought she was a widow, and, hang it, who should come in, but her husband the Baron. A big fellow, sir, with a blue coat, a red ribbing, and such a pair of mustachios." "Well," said I, "he didn't turn you out, I suppose?" "Oh, no. On the contrary, as kind as possible, his lordship said that he respected the English army. Asked me what corps I was in, said he had fought in Spain against us, and made me welcome. What could you want more?" Mr. Pogson at this only whistled, and if some very profound observer of human nature had been there to read into this little bagman's heart, it would, perhaps, have been manifest that the appearance of a whiskered soldier of a husband had counteracted some plans that the young scoundrel was concocting. "I live up 137 steps in the remote quarter of the Luxembourg, and it is not to be expected that such a fashionable fellow as Sam Pogson, with his pockets full of money and a new city to see, should be always wandering to my dull quarters. So that, although he did not make his appearance for some time, he must not be accused of any lukewarmness of friendship on that score. He was out too, when I called at his hotel. But once, I had the good fortune to see him, with his hat curiously on one side, looking as pleased as Punch, and being driven, in an open cab, in the Champs-Élysées. Hat's another tip-top chap," said he, when we met, at length. "Hat, do you think of an Earl's son, my boy? Honorable Tom Ringwood, son of the Earl of Cinqbers. What do you think of that, eh? I thought he was getting into very good society. Sam was a dashing fellow, and was always above his own line of life. He had met Mr. Ringwood at the Baron's, and they'd been to the play together. and the honorable gent, as Sam called him, had joked with him about being well-to-do in a certain quarter, and he had had a game of billiards with the baron, at the Estaminet, a very distangy place, where you smoke, said Sam, quite select, and frequented by the tip-top nobility, and they were as thick as peas in a shell, and they were to dine that day at Ringwood's, and sup, the next night, with the baroness. I think the chaps down the road will stare, said Sam, when they hear how I've been coming it. And stare, no doubt, they would, for it is certain that very few commercial gentlemen have had Mr. Pogson's advantages. The next morning we had made an arrangement to go out shopping together, and to purchase some articles of female gear that Sam intended to bestow on his relations when he returned. 7 needle books for his sisters, a gilt buckle for his mama, a handsome French cashmere shawl and bonnet for his aunt. The old lady keeps an inn in the borough, and has plenty of money, and no heirs, and a toothpick case for his father. Sam is a good fellow to all his relations, and as for his aunt, he adores her. Well, we were to go and make these purchases, and I arrived punctually at my time. But Sam was stretched on a sofa, very pale and dismal. I saw how it had been. Little too much of Mr. Ringwood's claret, I suppose? He only gave a sickly stare. Where does the Honorable Tom live? Says I, Honorable. Says Sam, with a hollow, horrid laugh. I tell you, Tit, he's no more honorable than you are. What, an impostor? No, no, not that. He is a real honorable, only, oh, ho. I smell a rat a little jealous, eh? Jealousy be hanged. I tell you he's a thief, and the baron's a thief, and, hang me, if I think his wife is any better. 8 and 30 pounds he won of me before supper, and made me drunk, and sent me home. Is that honorable? How can I afford to lose 40 pounds? It's took me 2 years to save it up. If my old aunt gets wind of it, she'll cut me off with a shilling. Hang me. And here Sam, in an agony, tore his fair hair. While bewailing his lot in this lamentable strain, his bell was rung, which signal being answered by a surly omen, a tall, very fashionable gentleman, with a fur coat and a fierce tuft to his chin, entered the room. Oxen, my buck, how goes it? Said he, familiarly, and gave a stare at me. I was making for my hat. Don't go, said Sam, rather eagerly, and I sat down again. The Honorable Mr. Ringwood hummed and hawed, and, at last, said he wished to speak to Mr. Pogson on business, in private, if possible. There's no secrets betwixt me and my friend, cried Sam. Mr. Ringwood paused a little. An awkward business, that of last night, at length exclaimed he. I believe it was an awkward business, said Sam, dryly. I really am very sorry for your losses. Thank you. And so am I can tell you, said Sam. You must mind, my good fellow, and not drink, for, when you drink, you will play high. By gad, you let us in, and not we you. I dare say, answered Sam, with something of peevishness. Losses is losses. There's no use talking about them when they're over and paid. And paid? Here wonderingly spoke Mr. Ringwood. Why, my dear fellow, what the deuce has Florval been with you? D. Florval, growled Sam, I've never set eyes on his face since last night, and never wish to see him again. Come, come, enough of this talk. How do you intend to settle the bills which you gave him last night? Bills, I what do you mean? I mean, sir, these bills, said the Honorable Tom, producing 2 out of his pocketbook, and looking as stern as a lion. I promise to pay, on demand, to the Baron de Florval, the sum of £400. October 20, 1838. Apostrophe 10 days after date I promise to pay the Baron de Akatira, £198. Samuel Pogson. Apostrophe, you didn't say what regiment you were in. What? Shouted poor Sam, as from a dream, starting up and looking preternaturally pale and hideous. Idiot, sir, you don't affect ignorance. You don't pretend not to remember that you signed these bills for money lost in my rooms. Money lent to you by Madame de Florville at your own request and lost to her husband? You don't suppose, sir, that I shall be such an infernal idiot as to believe you, or such a coward as to put up with a mean subterfuge of this sort. Will you, or will you not, pay the money, sir? I will not, said Sam, stoutly. It's a DD swin. Here Mr. Ringwood sprung up, clenching his riding whip, and looking so fierce that Sam and I bounded back to the other end of the room. Utter that word again, and, by heaven, I'll murder you, shouted Mr. Ringwood, and looked as if he would, to Colin once more, will you, or will you not, pay this money? I can't, said Sam faintly. I'll call again, Captain Poxon, said Mr. Ringwood, I'll call again in 1 hour, and, unless you come to some arrangement, you must meet my friend, the Baron de Florville, or I'll post you for a swindler and a coward. With this he went out. The door thundered to after him, and when the clink of his steps departing had subsided, I was enabled to look round at Pog. The poor little man had his elbows on the marble table, his head between his hands, and looked, as one has seen gentlemen look over a steam vessel off Ramsgate, the wind blowing remarkably fresh. At last he fairly burst out crying. If Mrs. Poxon heard of this, said I, what would become of the 3 tons? Apostrophe, for I wished to give him a lesson. If your ma, who took you every Sunday to meeting, should know that her boy was paying attention to married women. If Drench, Glauber, and company, comma your employers, were to know that their confidential agent was a gambler, and unfit to be trusted with their money, how long do you think your connection would last with them, and who would afterwards employ you? To this poor Pog had not a word of answer, but sat on his sofa whimpering so bitterly that the sternest of moralists would have relented towards him, and would have been touched by the little wretch's tears. Everything, too, must be pleaded in excuse for this unfortunate bagman, who, if he wished to pass for a captain, had only done so because he had an intense respect and longing for rank. If he had made love to the Baroness, had only done so because he was given to understand by Lord Byron's Antoine that making love was a very correct, natty thing. And if he had gambled, had only been induced to do so by the bright eyes and example of the Baron and the Baroness. O ye Barons and Baronesses of England! If ye knew what a number of small commoners are daily occupied in studying your lives and imitating your aristocratic ways, how careful would ye be of your morals, manners, and conversation! My soul was filled, then, with a gentle yearning pity for Poxon, and revolved many plans for his rescue. None of these seeming to be practicable, at last we hit on the very wisest of all, and determined to apply for counsel to no less a person than Major British. A blessing it is to be acquainted with my worthy friend, little Major British, and heaven, sure, it was that put the Major into my head, when I heard of this awkward scrape of poor Fox. The Major is on half pay, and occupies a modest apartment au quatrième, in the very hotel which Poxon had patronized at my suggestion. Indeed, I had chosen it from Major British's own peculiar recommendation. There is no better guide to follow than such a character as the honest Major, of whom there are many likenesses now scattered over the continent of Europe. Men who love to live well, and are forced to live cheaply, and who find the English abroad a 1,000 times easier, merrier, and more hospitable than the same persons at home. I, for my part, never landed on Calais Pier without feeling that a load of sorrows was left on the other side of the water, and have always fancied that Black Care stepped on board the steamer, along with the custom house officers at Gravesend, and accompanied one to yonder black lowering towers of London so busy, so dismal, and so vast. British would have cut any foreigner's throat who ventured to say so much, but entertained, no doubt, private sentiments of this nature, for the past 8 months of the year, regularly, abroad, with headquarters at Paris, the Garrets before alluded to, and only went to England for the month's shooting, on the grounds of his old colonel, now an old lord, of whose acquaintance the major was passably inclined to boast. He loved and respected, like a good staunch Tory as he is, every one of the English nobility, gave himself certain little airs of a man of fashion that were by no means disagreeable, and was, indeed, kindly regarded by such English aristocracy as he met in his little annual tours among the German courts, in Italy or in Paris, where he never missed an ambassador's night. He retailed to us, who didn't go, but were delighted to know all that had taken place, accurate accounts of the dishes, the dresses, and the scandal which had there fallen under his observation. He is, moreover, one of the most useful persons in society that can possibly be, for besides being incorrigibly duelsome on his own account, he is, for others, the most acute and peaceable counselor in the world, and has carried more friends through scrapes, and prevented more deaths than any member of the Humane Society. British never bought a single step in the army, as is well known. In 14 he killed a celebrated French fire-eater, who had slain a young friend of his, and living, as he does, a great deal with young men of pleasure, and good old sober family people, he is loved by them both, and has as welcome a place made for him at a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.